saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." Is this the man John the Baptist was waiting for? We met John last week, and he was like an apocalyptic Old Testament prophet that strode out of a book. He was like John Brown before the American Civil War. He was expecting fire and brimstone. He was expecting the present order to be torn apart. He was expecting that God would reach out of the sky to reward the rigorous, burn up the chaff of the religious leadership, and scare the wobbly straight or into the furnace with the unjust. And now we get this Jesus in the way that he starts this sermon on the Mount. Now, the Sermon on the Mount is actually one of the most controversial things Jesus ever said. And you'd think after 2,000 years, we'd sort of have this thing figured out by now. Craig Bloomberg, a New Testament scholar, says this about the sermon: "Perhaps no other religious discourse in the history of humanity has attracted the attention which has been devoted to the Sermon on the Mount. Philosophers and activists from many non-Christian perspectives have refused to worship Jesus, nevertheless have admired his ethic. In the 20th century, Mahatma Gandhi was the sermon's most famous non-Christian devotee. The literature on the sermon is vast." And when he says that, I doubt that many of you have any idea. In fact, one person, every Saturday I release a rough draft of this sermon on my YouTube channel. I like that because I get a lot of comments from it, and it helps me sort of figure out how I want to alter the sermon for Sunday. One person writes, could you recommend a book on the Sermon on the Mount? I gave him Dallas Willard's The Divine Conspiracy. But there are so many books on the Sermon on the Mount. You wouldn't believe it. One recent survey has itemized 36 different interpretations. Only 8 of the most significant and influential interpretations does he list. Another person, Virginia Stem Owens, who used to teach at Texas A&M in the 1980s, she wrote for the magazine, The Reformed Journal. She decided she taught English to students at Texas A&M, and she decided one year to give out copies of the Sermon on the Mount, completely apart from the Bible, to give it to her students and ask her students to write reaction papers to this book of literature. But you might imagine Texas in the 1980s, all the students would recognize probably the most famous sermon in all of human history, but in fact, most of them did not. And the response she got from the students, reading the Sermon on the Mount just sort of plain, was rather surprising. Why were these students so angry at what they had just read and so blithe in their dismissal of it? My own introduction to the Sermon on the Mount as a child in Sunday school had been accompanied by pastel poster illustrations of Jesus sitting like a patient Mr. Rogers on a green hillside surrounded by eager pink children. It had never occurred to me either to be angry or to turn away from such a scene. As I read on, the student papers that it was, the answer to the first part of my question became quite clear. To wit, the stuff the churches preach is extremely strict and allows for almost no fun without thinking it is sin or not. I did not like the essay, Sermon on the Mount. It was hard to read and made me feel like I had to be perfect, and no one is. The thing asked in this sermon were absurd. To look at a woman as adultery? That is the most extreme, stupid, unhuman statement I have ever heard. At this point, I began to be encouraged. There was something exquisitely innocent about not realizing you shouldn't call Jesus stupid. This was not exactly intellectual agnosticism talking here, usually the perceived foe of the faith. It was just down-home hedonism. It was Herod watching Salome dance. It was the disciples asking, who then can be saved, when Jesus deflated their dreams of wealth with the needle's eye. This was the real thing, a pristine response to the gospel, unfiltered through a 2,000-year cultural haze. One of the people that I've been spending a lot of time talking with over the last 4 years is a cognitive scientist from the University of Toronto named John Verbeke. John Verbeke is not a Christian. He was raised in a fundamentalist Christian group, which left such a distaste in his mouth, he has struggled with it his whole life. He's been in and out of different churches. He studied Tai Chi, he studied Buddhism, he studied all sorts of world religions, and now he's addressing what he calls the meaning crisis to help people who are post-religious and basically struggling with nihilism. And he's doing a new series on YouTube that he and I talk about. He, myself, and Jonathan Peugeot, a third in our little trio, we're going to have a conference down in May in the Cross Point Church in Chino, California. But he's releasing a new video series called After Socrates. And he used a word called aporia that scholars of Socrates for many years have noted with the Socratic method. If you studied Socrates at college, you know something about the man. He was a gadfly, and he annoyed people in ancient Athens because he would sit down with people and he would ask them questions. And he would say, like in Plato's Republic, he would ask them a question, well, what is it that makes one person good and one person bad? Well, it's because there's good people and bad people. Oh, okay. Are they born that way or are they raised that way? And people would give answers to his questions, and then he would say, okay, and then he would ask them another question, and the people he would talk to would begin to realize, this guy is really annoying. Not because he's asking stupid questions, but because if you ask someone, do you know the difference between right and wrong? Oh, yeah, sure, I've known that since I was 5. Well, tell me the difference. And then people pause, and they begin to realize, I don't know how to explain the difference between right and wrong. Well, why don't you know how to explain the difference between right and wrong? You told me you knew the difference. Well, I kind of know the difference, but if we have to give a definition, and on and on and on and on. And for this behavior, Socrates was in fact killed by the city of Athens, who found him so totally annoying. But of course, one of his greatest students, Plato, wrote about Socrates, and Socrates, for that reason, is famous throughout the world. But this method that Socrates used was called aporia. It's an unsettling, disorienting, dissonance-creating rhetorical method to break the audience's preconception in order to ready them for a new way to think and to be. And so Plato or Socrates would walk into a situation and people would say, I know what love is, I know what justice is, I know what good is. And through a series of questions, he would begin to show them that they really had a very shallow idea about love, very shallow idea about justice, a very shallow idea about good, bad, right, and wrong, and all the things that meant so much to them. They're just sort of living on the surface. And Plato wanted to make the point that this surface living is the cause of a lot of our problems, and people, in fact, should think long and hard about their lives and about what they do. Because most people are sort of a mile wide and an inch deep. Aporia has been used by Socrates and just about everybody else since to sort of break people of facile, shallow, unexamined assumptions about life. Now, the Beatitudes that we read sound lovely, and you'll often hear them read, quoted, alluded to in our culture because people say, well, these are ideals. These are so lovely. But as I noted out with Craig Bloomberg, actually, if you start to ask questions, are these prescriptions? Are these rules? Are these descriptions? A lot of this stuff sort of falls apart. And as this woman who taught at Texas A&M noted, give it to a bunch of college sophomores and ask them to analyze it, well, they'll kind of have a fit. Because Jesus says a whole bunch of things that, whereas if everybody's sort of accustomed to hearing something and they say, ah, that's nice, sort of like crossing your heart when you pledge allegiance to the flag or standing up at the ballpark with the national anthem, it's just sort of a reaction that's been bred into you from your youth. Christians read them for their shocking beauty, but the haze of two millennia has obscured the shocking strangeness of this text. Anyone familiar with the genre would feel the aporia that Jesus is producing in his audience. You don't, because you're both used to this, and you're probably not quite as fluent in the Old Testament as Jesus' audience was. As Pete noted, Psalm 1 is a beatitude. So is Psalm 32. So is Psalm 33. So is Psalm 40. So is Psalm 41. Find one in Psalm 65, Psalm 94, Psalm 122, Psalm 128. You'll find them in the book of Proverbs. It's a very common form of discourse. Beatitudes are quite commonly found in Psalms and Proverbs, and they're very easy. You can take a lot of life. Blessed are those who eat well and exercise regularly, for they will have good health. Blessed are those who save their money and don't spend money frivolously, for they will become wealthy. Blessed are you if you are kind and good to your neighbor, because then in the day of trouble, your neighbor will help you. These are beatitudes. They're very normal, they're very regular, and they are a way of expressing good deeds beget good outcomes. It's pretty much what we imagine the term religion to talk about either divine or natural reward. Some of you know that some Roman Catholic Bibles have extra books. And if you read those extra books, most of those extra books were written after Malachi and before the New Testament period, and most of them are Jewish wisdom literature. And they're full of beatitudes. Blessed is the man who does not blunder with his lips and need not suffer grief from sin. It's like, blessed is the person who's careful with their speech, for they won't needlessly offend their neighbors. Blessed is he whose heart does not condemn him, who has not given up hope. Blessed is the man who meditates on wisdom and who reasons intelligently. Blessed is the rich man who is found blameless. Morality and wealth at the same time, it's the best of both worlds, isn't it? Blessed is the soul of the man who fears the Lord, to whom he looks and who is his support. Blessed is he who concerns himself with these things, and he who lays them to heart will become wise. These are guides for living, often concerning wealth and generosity. And if you're familiar with this, and then you go back and take a look at Jesus' Beatitudes, things get very strange. This is not the expectations of piety. This is not your expectations of the world. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Well, what does that mean? Well, we want to think about being rich in spirit. Poor in spirit nearly means depressed. They can barely get out of bed in the morning. Life has been brutal to them and crushed them down. Blessed are the depressed, for they will thrive. You'd say, no, Pastor. Blessed are the happy, for they will thrive. Blessed are the depressed. What do the depressed get? A bottle of wine and a subscription to Netflix. There it is. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Really? Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. I don't like to mourn. Do you like to mourn? It's almost the opposite of comfort. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. You've known meek people. They're the ones who never ask for a raise. They're the ones that the world steps on, and they don't even say, ouch, lest they offend the one who's stepping on them. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Steve Martin said it best in his movie, Leap of Faith. All the meek get is the short end of the stick. None of this makes any sense. The college students weren't lying. Neither are these completely out of line with the story of Israel, however. Because again and again and again in the Old Testament, it says things like, gospel, the Lord has concern for widows and orphans. The Lord cares for the oppressed. The Lord will lift up the downtrodden. If you've ever seen the song of Mary in the Gospel of Luke, you'll recognize the song of Hannah in the book of Samuel. So in other words, by nature, you would look at this and say, Jesus, this can't be right. But Jesus is saying, God's kingdom is coming in. And the poor in spirit can have hope. And those who mourn will receive comfort. And the meek, those who don't even stand up for themselves, they're going to get a windfall they can't possibly imagine. This is what's called in fancy theological terms, inaugurated eschatology. The end has come near. The kingdom of God has come near. Jesus is announcing a new beginning, a new thing. Something new is starting. It is hope to the crushed and wobbly in Israel. Israel's hope has come near, Jesus is announcing. He's not saying piety won't be rewarded. In fact, he's saying piety will be rewarded. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Go ahead and watch a political battle and step in and express mercy for the other side. See how the two sides react to that. Oh, no, both-andism here. Oh, no, we won't tolerate you having any kind of mercy for the enemy of the other side. That's the way the world works. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. You know what we call the pure in heart? Naive. It isn't out of line with God's promises to Israel, but it is out of line with Israel's experience of her piety. Because whenever you see someone practice this, they become a loser. Oh, I don't want to be by them. They're losers. They're a doormat. They don't stick up for themselves. The world walks all over them. Israel's devotion to God has gotten her vassal status and diaspora in a pagan empire. This is the hope that the little person who hopes in God will not be forgotten. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Just look at two people who want to fight. Go ahead, get in the middle of them, see what happens. It's a great old Buster Keaton movie, A Silent Picture, where there's this husband and wife, they're outside their door, they're fighting, and he smacks the woman. Buster Keaton gets up, smacks the man. The woman gets up, smacks Buster Keaton. We all know this. When people want to fight, they want to fight. And then if the peacemaker steps in, they both attack the peacemaker. They will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Nobody lines up to be persecuted. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. What looks to the world like a losing hand in God's eschatological intervention will prove to be the greatest possible hope. Now, before I talked about nature religion and escape religion, this certainly isn't nature religion, where natural outcomes of your choices prove to be clearly rewarded in this world. It seems like escape religion, because the payoff will come after the breaking of this world order. You are the salt of the earth, but if your salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? Jesus first sounds like he's talking about escape religion, and now he breaks the frame, and it almost sounds like nature religion, because Jesus says, even though you're the losers, and the little, and the downtrodden, and the despised, you are the salt of the earth. It can't get along without you. And if you lose your distinctiveness, you're worth nothing. Why do you lose your distinctiveness? Well, that's, you know how you lose your distinctiveness? You just go along with the crowd. Why do you go along with the crowd? Because if you don't, you get persecuted. You're like Buster Keaton, got smacked by the wife after he tries to defend her. You're like the meek. Jesus says, all of these crazy, countercultural, counterproductive things that I'm calling you to be, if you finally give that up and just go along with the rest of the crowd, well, if salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. Yes, you. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Salt is distinct. You taste it. Light and darkness cannot be missed. And Jesus is saying to his disciples, you will be the light of the world. First part of the Gospel of John, and they will hate the light. I once told a friend this, and he said, who would want to be a Christian? This sounds nuts. It sounds absolutely crazy. You're going to turn the other cheek. You're going to bless people who curse you. You're going to try and make peace with both sides. What they really want is to tear each other up. Yeah. Well, how would this work? I don't know. Have you ever heard of Jesus? Everybody knows Jesus. See? There it is. The students who don't know anything about Jesus read his sermon and say, this is nuts. But go to anybody who has any education, who's Jesus? Well, you know, he's a great moral teacher. Really? Have you read any of his stuff? No, but I've just heard he's a great moral teacher. He's about kindness and love and those things. Oh, you think kindness and love are good? How about kindness and love for those people over there? No, not for those people. Oh, okay. I understand. aporia is breaking. Jesus starts his sermon with these beatitudes, and everyone is expecting to hear, "Blessed are those who eat much fiber, for they will have good health. Blessed are those who have gym memberships and work out all the time and do exactly what the doctor says, for they will live long." Jesus says, "Blessed are the depressed, for they're going to get it all." What? Blessed are the meek, for everything good is going to come to them. No, you only get what you get if you fight for it in this world. Jesus is saying, the world is upside down, and I'm announcing it right side up. But it's upside down because you want it upside down, and that's why you're going to kill me. And they will. John the Baptist is promising shock and awe. Is this it? It's strange. It's not what John is looking for. Jesus comes with what begins as a subtle hope that both makes university students mock and skeptics walk away. Could this man who raises no army nor assassinates any pagan warlord really bring the transformation of history and heaven's invasion? The aporia that Jesus sets up in the Sermon on the Mount becomes flesh in his crucifixion. Remember his disciples? Jesus says, "We're going down to Jerusalem." And his disciples say, "That's a bad idea, Jesus. If you go to Jerusalem, they're going to kill you." And Jesus says, "Sit down a minute. We're going to go to Jerusalem. They're going to arrest me, just like you think. They're going to execute me, just like you think. And then I'm going to rise from the dead." They didn't remember any of the rise from the dead stuff because that just went right over their head. And they thought, "Jesus, this is a bad plan. This is the worst way to change the world. We need to stay in Galilee, get more and more popular, and because we don't have democracy here, let's just start overthrowing cities." And, well, that's the way every revolution works. And so then when Jesus says, "I'm going to Jerusalem," and he goes, and what everyone knew would happen happens, when Jesus is executed, just the women and young, John and the women, stay by the cross because they don't bother basically arresting children and women. And the men all hide and they fall into despair because they had such hope for this man. And then he went and did this stupid, stupid thing. But was it stupid? If I mention the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135 AD, in Judea, most of you say, "Never heard of that." I can name two or three Jewish revolutionaries at the same period of time who tried to overthrow Rome. You don't know their names. But Jesus, oh yeah, Jesus, he's like a great moral teacher. Oh, seems his plan worked. The disciples are scattered and despondent. Poor in spirit gets the Roman cross. The meek get the business end of the stick. The merciful, he's not shown any mercy. The peacemaker, well, the Romans and the Jewish nationals were really itching to go at each other. They hated each other, but they could temporarily agree for a truce so they could stop long enough to kill Jesus. The peacemaker is brutally mocked and killed. That's aporia. Nature and escape religion come together in resurrection and ascension. The poor in spirit receives the kingdom. The meek, Jesus, meek, yes indeed, he inherits the earth. The merciful, he receives mercy from God the Father himself in the form of his resurrection. The peacemaker is recognized even by a Roman centurion as the Son of God. Beatitudes continue to be the entryway into disrupting the status quo of a world that knows how to brutally enforce its iron laws. It continues to give us hope that following Jesus, living his life, receiving his baptism, dying like he did, will bring his resurrection. Read the Beatitudes. Go and do so. Let's pray. Lord, it's a strange thing we can't get our mind around, so you break all of our normal ways of thinking. And you ask us into this very challenging thing of following you. Help us, Lord, to learn and grow in it. Help us, Lord, to be transformed by it. Help us, Lord, to walk as you walk. Hear our prayer. In the name of Jesus, amen.